Before we dive into the episode, I wanted to let you know I have a free on-demand masterclass called 5 Steps to Writing a Novel Without Letting Perfectionism or Procrastination Get in the Way. In this free training, I cover things like where perfectionism comes from, how it's directly linked to procrastination, and what you can do right now to start making real progress with your writing. I also talk about the problem with popular plotting methods and how they can do more harm than good, especially if you're brand new to writing. And last but certainly not least, I share some of the most common mistakes I see writers make so you can avoid them and make this the year you finish your novel. If this sounds like something you're interested in, you can sign up for free at savannahgilbo.com/training. One more time, that's savannahgilbo.com/training to get your hands on this free masterclass.
The difference between a beat versus a scene. Maybe in a scene, there's a value shift, but in a beat, there's a change in tactic. That is when we start to kind of look at this. Can we argue that maybe it's not a value shift in the first chapter? It's actually a change in tactic. And There's actually a value shift only in the change of one scene, two chapters.
So pausing there on the change in tactic. So she's referring to if his goal is to stay off Vernon's radar and to not get in trouble, it's like now that Dudley's out here with me and bullying me, how am I going to get around this to still accomplish my goal? So his tactic changes, but nothing big picture necessarily is changing.
Yes. And this is why I think I'm really going to side with one scene, two chapters.
Welcome to the Fiction Writing Made Easy podcast. My name is Savannah Gilbo, and I'm here to help you write a story that works. I want to prove to you that writing a novel doesn't have to be overwhelming. So each week, I'll bring you a brand new episode with simple, actionable, and step-by-step strategies that you can implement in your writing right away. So whether you're brand new to writing or more of a seasoned author looking to improve your craft, this podcast is for you. So pick up a pen and let's get started. In today's episode, we're diving deep into the first chapter of Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. And I'm super excited to share this episode with you because not only am I a huge Harry Potter fan, and not only do I think this is another great example of an opening chapter, but I'm also joined by a very special guest and fellow developmental editor and Harry Potter nerd, Abigail Perry. Abigail is the host of the Lit Match podcast, where she helps fiction writers find the best literary agent for their writing and publishing career. I will link to her podcast in the show notes, as well as where you can find Abigail around the internet if you would like to say hello. But in this episode, we discuss and analyze the first chapter of Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. Specifically, we look at how the first chapter engages readers from the start and how it sets up expectations for the rest of the book. To do this, we look at the big picture of the chapter first, and then we talk about the scene structure. So we look at how and why the big picture of the chapter works, and then we zoom into the scene level to see how the scene serves an important purpose in the overarching story. So that's a quick overview of what we're going to dig into today, and without further ado, let's dive right into the conversation.
I think it's worth talking about what chapter we're actually talking about. So remember that these episodes are based on first chapters. We're looking at first chapters because we want to learn what makes a first chapter engaging and what would catch the attention of a literary agent, of a reader, of an editor, what's really going to get us to read forward. And what's super interesting in particular about Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets is that this is the second book in a series. So we've already had the success of Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, which we talked about in the first Harry Potter first chapter breakdowns that we've been doing. And now we're looking at the second book. Just to kind of reemphasize, we are going to go over the big picture of a story. We will go through the 7 key questions we use to analyze first chapters and assess what makes it interesting and engaging. And Savannah's going to walk us through that first. And then we're going to go into the small picture and look at the actual scene level and how it is working on a fundamental level. I'm going to give you a brief summary for both chapter one and chapter two, even though our discussion will heavily be focused on chapter one. For chapter one, this is the worst birthday. And a summary of chapter one is Harry Potter endures a miserable 12th birthday at Privet Drive. In the garden, he thinks about his Hogwarts friends who seem to have forgotten him. He also spots 2 giant eyes in a hedge, but Dudley interrupts him before he can investigate the eyes. Dudley taunts Harry and Harry pretends to do magic. And because he does this, of course, he's punished because he's living with the Dursleys who despise magic and all worms. And then the second chapter, we're going to get into an event with a beloved character of mine and many Harry Potter fans. This, of course, is the introduction of Dobby. Chapter 2 is called Dobby's Warning. And this is essentially what happens in that chapter. A house elf named Dobby warns Harry not to return to Hogwarts this year. Terrible things are going to happen. And because of this, Harry needs to pry more information out of Dobby, but unfortunately gets none because Dobby is a house elf. And as soon as he gets close to revealing information, he punishes himself, which of course causes noise to the point where basically Harry chases Dobby down into the kitchen. The Masons are in the living room. And there's, of course, the prized cake that Aunt Petunia has baked. And Dobby essentially warns Harry that he will do something if Harry doesn't promise not to go back to Hogwarts. When Harry refuses to promise that, Dobby levitates the cake, drops it on the Mason's head. Since magic has been used in the Dursley house, it's flagged that underage wizardry has been going on. So Harry's warned, and he eventually gets locked in his bedroom, even to the point of bars on the window. Let's look at the big picture first, and then we'll tackle the small picture and how it's analyzed.
Right. And so to do that, we're going to look at the same thing we did last time, which is those seven questions that Paula Meunier gives us in her book, The Writer's Guide to Beginnings, How to Craft Story Openings That Sell. So if you haven't picked up this book yet, it is well worth grabbing. Both Abigail and I love it. And question number one is about genre. So Abigail, what kind of story is this based on the first chapter?
We have a 12-year-old protagonist, and it's still middle grade fantasy. There is a specific freak out on the Dursley's part when we mention magic. Harry mentions magic, not even in the sense of actual magic, but he wants Dudley to say, please.
Say the magic word.
Say the magic word. But the Dursleys freak out, and you kind of get context in the sense that magic is something that the Dursleys absolutely despise in every way. And Harry is kind of like the epitome of what magic is. So it's a huge discussion there, but we don't actually see magic used like we do in the first chapter, the prologue, in Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. We do see magic used in chapter 2, but we are very aware that magic is a real thing, especially since a lot of backstory is shared here in context of the first book. And we understand what Hogwarts is, and it's kind of a recap. Another really interesting thing that's done here, because I don't think that the amount of backstory that is shared in the first chapter of Harry Potter and the Chambers of Secrets would work as a first chapter of any other book if it wasn't the sequel to the first book in a series.
Yes. And something that's interesting about that is I read a lot of adult fantasy series. And I was thinking about this last night. I'm like, okay, so is this an appropriate amount of backstory for any series, whether it's middle grade, young adult, or adult? And then I started thinking, I wonder if we have that kind of learning curve we talked about last time with world building, but also with backstory, where it's like, we do need to kind of spell it out maybe a little more because we're in middle grade, whereas something like this may not be the best option for an adult fantasy, even though we need to recap still if it's like book two or three in a series. So just something interesting to think about. I don't know the right answer to that or the right balance, but this is a good example of when it works, because Abigail and I were talking last night, we're still interested in this, even though there is backstory and exposition. It doesn't slow down the narrative for us or for readers. And one thing about this opening chapter too is, how do we know it's an action story? Because we talk about commercial and content genres, right? So what do you think about that?
Yeah. And I love that you're asking this question, because this is what had Ben and me spinning a lot while analyzing this. Harry Potter as a series and as a book is, I would argue, an action content genre. The main question we're worried about here is Harry going to survive or not? And inside of information that is shared through telling, through backstory, in the first chapter of Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, there is very briefly, before we see the eyes in the hedge, a mentioning of Voldemort and how he is this dangerous wizard who has disappeared temporarily until he came back last year. So we know he's still after Harry, and he is still actively trying to find a body of sorts, right? To return to full power. So it's really interesting, because the death stakes, the life and death stakes, are not on the table in this first chapter in our faces, in the sense that Harry's life doesn't seem like it's threatened through the context of the events that are unfolding. There is the sense of, yes, he is neglected by the Dursley family and there's a lot going on with there. But isn't life or death stakes danger? Not really. So you go ahead and you look at these eyes in the hedge. And what I think is particularly smart of Rowling and how she placed details right before that moment is that because we've read Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, we understand how dangerous Voldemort actually is to the point of working up always to probably a life or death battle in the end.
Right.
You know, and I think that in Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, you're maybe getting one of the best hero at the mercy of the villain scenes in the series. It's the basilisk scene, but we're not really paying attention to the life and death stakes as much in that first chapter. And I think that's what really is difficult. It's like, you know, there are elements of life and death. We're really more paying attention to Harry longing to go back to Hogwarts. Now, in the second chapter, you are going to get those life and death stakes.
We'll go there, right? So one thing that you always talk about is the three different types of death too.
Mm-hmm.
So in this first chapter, there's a lot about like, my friends forgot me. No one knows my birthday. What if they're not really my friends? So would that count as something like a psychological death?
This is why I think it's so interesting, because you and I have talked about this many, many times about how why we love the Harry Potter series so much is because it's not just life and death. It deals so much with coming of age and that psychological death. And to me, the first chapter is more heavily focused on psychological death. And I feel like we're really focusing on character in this first chapter.
Right. Okay, cool. So I agree with all that. So let's move on to number two, which is plot. What is the story really about? How do we get a sense of that in this first chapter?
Yep.
And you kind of did touch on this a little bit because we get that exposition, right?
Mm-hmm. That's the big thing. It's like, we know that we're going to go to Hogwarts. So what is the story really about? When we're looking at this first chapter, I think that we're looking at this boy who is really starting to question his identity and kind of where he fits within his world. And then at the same time, like, those stakes are going to get even bigger in chapter two, where it becomes unraveling of this mystery of the terrible things that are going to happen. So it's tricky because when I look at what is the story really about in the first chapter versus the whole book, the whole book is really about the opening of the Chamber of Secrets. But a big thing that later happens in the Chamber of Secrets that kind of happens in this first chapter, but isn't fully explored, but gives us a taste of what's going to be something that Harry grapples with internally, is his really fear that he might actually be the heir of Slytherin.
Right, right. And the one cool thing is, like we said earlier, the exposition. It reminds us there's this thing with Voldemort. It reminds us that he tried to kill Harry as a baby and that he's still out there. Even though we're not 100% seeing that on the page as it's actually like affecting Harry, we're being reminded of that in that first chapter. And it's interesting because Abigail and I were talking too yesterday. If we took out kind of this whole first chapter and started with something like Dobby being on Harry's bed, that would give us a lot more insight into like what this particular story is about. But because it's within a series, you know, we do need to catch the reader up on what happened in book one.
Right.
Especially for a middle grade audience. So, okay. Question number three, point of view, who's telling the story?
We're in third person limited, sticking close to Harry. I think the first sentence or second sentence feels a little bit more zoomed out, and then it quickly zooms in to Harry's POV. And we'll be a lot more consistent with third person limited throughout the rest of the story.
And there's a few spots I noticed that we do zoom out a little. So like you said, that first or second sentence, I can't remember.
Yeah.
There's a part where it's like, in fact, Harry was as not normal as it was possible to be. Harry was a wizard. And then later we zoom out when we're told the physical differences between Harry and the Dursleys. So there's a part that's like, you know, the Dursleys are,
that's right,
you know, Vernon's dark haired. And I think Petunia and Dudley are blonde. And then and they're bigger people. And Harry's very small and scrawny, you know, and so it's interesting because, again, like we talked about last time, we don't really notice this unless you're looking for it. Question number four is about character. So who should we care about the most in this opening chapter?
Yeah. And Harry, of course, who is ever going to cheer for Team Dursley unless you are, I don't know, Barney on How I Met Your Mother? Like, he's going to cheer for the Dursleys, maybe.
And it's speaking of cheering for the Dursleys, I wrote down some of the little humorous things we get about Vernon, because this is middle grade. And like we talked about last time, we do want that element of humor. So it's funny because we're setting up Vernon with its humor, but we're also making him a little bit unlikable, or he's like the villain. Yes. Fried egg dangles from his mustache. We compare him to an angry rhino. He spits when he yells.
Yes.
We get a description of Dudley later that his bottom is so large, it droops over the sides of his chair. Just little things. I meant to call those out when we talked about genre. And then question number five is about setting. So where and when does the story take place?
Mm-hmm. So we know that it is the second year that Harry is going to go to Hogwarts. So when we're looking at setting in place, we know it's his 12th birthday. So we know it's July. We know that he's on summer vacation. We know it's Privet Drive, so we're back in Surrey, London. And I think that overall, we're kind of grounding ourselves with Harry's age. We're moving with the school year, and we get grounded each summer, which is where all the books always start.
Yeah, and speaking of that, I had a note, too, to talk about the construction of each of these books. Like, there's reasons, story-wise, why Harry needs to be with the Dursleys, but it's also kind of interesting to think about from the author's perspective. If we were to start our books in this familiar way, not only is it maybe a little easier for us because we're like, here's the format we're working with. We know we're going to drop into Harry's life in the summer. We're going to follow him as he goes to Hogwarts. But also it creates that sense of like we can drop in as readers and feel like, okay, we're back in Harry Potter. It's the same thing, just different new year, you know. So it's kind of just interesting to note.
Yep.
Question number six is core emotions. So how should we feel about what's happening next or what's happening in this opening chapter as a reader?
Looking at the first chapter, I think that we feel kind of bad and worried for Harry.
We
feel super bad. He's super miserable. He's only 12, you know? Yeah. I mean, not that anyone deserves a miserable birthday, but particularly a 12-year-old feeling that alone as a 12-year-old and basically being bossed around the whole day and locked in his room. Like, it's bad.
The best year of his life too. So he had the best year. He made friends. He found a place he belonged. And now it's like crickets.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of Harry's strengths is that he's able to build allies that are good allies around him.
Yeah.
And this is suffocated it from him in this moment. You know, it's like he's cut off from them and he doesn't understand why no one is reaching out. So just when you thought that you might have allies for life, now you're hearing nothing. Like that's, and then you're being bullied, you know?
And this plays on his wound too, of like, you're so different that you're weird, which sets up this whole thing for the Chamber of Secrets. If he is the heir of Slytherin, it's like exasperating that wound a lot more. Mm-hmm. So it's very purposeful in the way that she set this up.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of leads us to the next question perfectly, which is what's at stake or why should we care what happens next?
Mm-hmm. Stakes are essential to any story, right? Especially when we care about characters, because even if there are life and death stakes on the line, we won't care about those life and death stakes if we don't care about the character who would die in those stakes. Now, for the stakes, for this first chapter, again, I think we have to go back to what whiff of death are we dealing with? We're dealing with kind of psychological death. So what are the stakes here? There are stakes in the sense of Harry Potter, and is he going to be reunited with the friends that he thought were super loyal with him, right? And then I think also there are these stakes of, is danger coming? And that danger that we start to feel suspense for after seeing the eyes in the hedge that disappear comes full force in the second chapter, when basically Dobby tells Harry, if you return to Hogwarts, terrible things are going to happen.
Right. And so what's really cool, we talked about this last time too, is this, depending on which level of analysis you kind of look at the opening chapter for, we have the psychological stakes. We care about, we're concerned about Harry as a kid, as a person. We also are reminded about this bigger war with Voldemort. So we care about that too. Mm-hmm. And then we're curious, like, how is Voldemort going to show up? Because he most likely is. What do these eyes in the bush mean? Does that have to do with Voldemort? So we're kind of playing on both the curiosity and concern on different levels.
Yeah, for sure.
So those are the seven questions. And you guys will see why it's interesting to look at the chapter versus the scenes in a second, because we're going to move there. Mm-hmm. But I think we can agree this is a fun case study of, like, why does this opening chapter full of so much exposition hook us?
Yeah.
Is it just because it's Harry Potter, or, you know, I don't know. I think we just got to some of that. So,
right. No, and I think that's a great question, Savannah, because in most writing instruction, you'd say you can't have that much exposition without losing your readers, which brings us to the scene analysis. So we've already kind of gone over what the two summaries are. And I think the big case study focus for today is this two scenes in two chapters, or is it one scene over the course of the first and second chapter?
Yes. And just like last time, we're going to show you kind of the two different ways we could analyze this, because I'll speak for Abigail. She's looked at this in so many different ways that we've probably had versions of different breakdowns over the years that she's been looking at this. But so we're going to look at, like, if we just look at what we could call scene one in chapter one, what would that look like? And then we're going to look at what happens if it is a longer scene that spans two chapters.
Mm-hmm. So before we even do that, Savannah, I think it's worth taking a pause and discussing why, and I believe that you believe this too, scenes and chapters are different.
Right. So to me, chapters are kind of arbitrary, and I hate saying that word because it feels mean. Chapters are kind of arbitrary in the sense that there's certain things they need to do, but their main purpose is to control how the reader is experiencing something. So I know chapter one ends with like Harry walking into his bedroom and a creature's on his bed, or he's not alone. I can't remember the exact words. So it's like that at the end, we get the setup. We're in this world. We know like what Vernon and everybody wants. We get hooked by that last, like, what the heck is this creature doing? Is that who the eyes belong to? And then scenes are like little mini units of story that move the narrative along. You can break up a scene however you want. So we're going to go through the five commandments, the storytelling, and just keep this little nugget of information in mind that you can break the scene. You can do a chapter break at the inciting incident, the turning point, the crisis, the climax, the resolution, wherever you want to break it to create that ideal reading experience, but you can't leave the elements of a scene out.
Yes. And I want to dig into that a little bit more, if you don't mind, I've had a lot of writers agree with it. Like they agree with this. And it actually, I think becomes exciting because it's a lot easier to plot out a story in scenes versus chapters.
For sure.
But how do you then fall when a chapter ends versus when a scene ends? So we'll say hypothetically, if we go with today at the end of this, that actually it's one scene over chapter one in chapter two. Why do you think there is a benefit to having chapter one be what it is in the published draft versus just one making it chapter. One long chapter?
Yeah. And so part of it is I think there's this gratification, especially for young readers, of like, I finished a chapter that feels good to me. I'm going to finish another one. I mean, and also the way that she ends this first chapter, we're on something that's so interesting, right? If we left it as one long chapter, it's going to be over 5,000 words, I think. I don't know the exact number, but it's pretty long. So it's almost like if you introduce a reader to that experience of one 5,000 word chapter right away, that might be a little tough for some middle grade readers to swallow. If you're writing adult fantasy that's like, you know, 800 plus pages long, that's different because adult fantasy readers expect that. They want that. I'll sit in a chapter as an adult fantasy reader as long as you want me to. Just give me the stuff, you know? So it's to control readers' experience, to reward them for finishing the chapter, to entice them to go to the next chapter. And maybe you can answer this better because you analyzed the book, but I'm assuming that there's not a bunch of 5,000 word chapters in this story.
Chamber of Secrets, I would actually argue there are, but I don't think that that is the norm as gets further into the series. So this is speculation, but like any author, you become a stronger writer as you write forward. Now, I think that all of the Harry Potter books are masterworks. I think that they're all masterpieces in my opinion. But I do think that the execution of tightening scenes gets stronger as the series grows.
Right.
So it's interesting because like when I was, this is I think what made actually analyzing the earlier books of Harry Potter harder than analyzing the books that are later in the series. Now, of course, like Savannah and I are certified story grid editors. So this is one way of looking at analyzing scenes. It's not the only way of looking at how to analyze scenes. But I think that ultimately I've noticed, at least Chamber of Secrets, there were some chapters that had me spinning and still have me spinning. Like chapter 6 about Gilderoy Lockhart is the hardest chapters I have ever analyzed. So I do think that there's more of them in Chamber of Secrets, but I don't think that the main scenes exceed, you know, around 2,500, 3,000 words.
Right. There's so many layers that we could get into, and I'm trying to like corral myself down in here.
Yeah.
Also, just think about from book one to book two, there's already tightening happening, because in book one, we have this prologue in disguise, like we call it. And then we have all these scenes until we get to Hogwarts. We get to Hogwarts a lot quicker in book two. Some of that is because it's book two, but also some of it is she's more efficient with what she's doing.
Yeah. So now let's move on to the scenes. Just to reemphasize, the big question here is it two scenes, two chapters, or one scene, two chapters? So that's kind of what the case study is about. Originally, in my analysis, my latest analysis before our conversation last night,
just yesterday,
like mere hours away, we're under 24 hours, I had it as two scenes, two chapters. I do think that there is an argument for that. I'm not convinced it's the strongest one anymore. So I think that that's what we really want to dig into. So Savannah, how do you want to tackle this? Do you want to just go analyzing it in a way that you think it's two scenes, two chapters, or do we just want to go for maybe the argument of one scene over two chapters?
Let's do both. So let's quickly do, like, you do the version that you have currently in your draft. Mm-hmm. And let's talk about if chapter one was one scene, what does that look like? Because the thing that's important is, like, when we look at this, we're holding hands. We're so excited that there's two ways we could nerd out about this. Neither one are necessarily wrong or right. They're both going to get us to the same answer at the end of the day. And there's, for all the story nerds out there, if we do end up looking at chapter one and two as one long scene, you can still use the breakdown that Abigail is going to go through as, like, if this is a beat. So like a mini scene within a scene. And you could just see how this structure kind of builds on itself to create a bigger scene. Scenes work together to build sequences. Sequences build acts and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. And that, what Savannah's saying is really great, and why I think this is a particularly interesting discussion, because when you're looking at scenes, all scenes must be about change. So the idea here of what is the main change, and that's based on the characters' want and what they try to do in order to achieve that want in some way. So in the first chapter, you might see this as a scene, you might see it as a beat, and a beat still has to have the five commandments. Just looking at that, I would say for the motive for Harry in this first chapter, it's stay out of the Dursleys' way. With that goal, we have to first look at the inciting incident, and the inciting incident, just as a recap, is an unexpected disturbance that really starts to establish a character's goal, or if the character already has a goal, it sets them off on a new way that they have to go forward and try to achieve that goal. It's causal, meaning that a person causes it, or coincidental, meaning that some sort of coincidence happens. Right. For me, for that first scene, if you were to look at it as a scene, or if you look at it as a beat, whatever you're going to take that, I think it's causal. I said everyone forgets Harry's birthday. So it's kind of there, but not necessarily there. But Harry does mention everyone has forgotten him. Did you see it as something different?
Well, yes. So do we want to go into the other version now, or do we want to?
I think so, because this is where I keep leaning now, and we'll see that my answer was a little bit like, eh?
So the reason why I was looking for a different inciting incident is because I'm like, well, Harry knows it's his birthday. He didn't really expect the Dursleys to remember it. He hasn't been getting communication from his friends. So, like, although he can hope it's going to come, evidence doesn't really point that way, right? So it's kind of like, it's a little bit of a squishy, even Abigail was kind of doing this, like, I don't know. It's a little bit of a squishy one. What I called out and what I think his goal is that he wants to stay off Vernon's radar. Like Abigail said, just by obeying whatever Vernon wants, he wants the Mason's visit to go well, because that matters to Vernon. And if it goes well, he survives another day in this house. So I actually see the inciting incident, if we were looking at this whole chapter one and chapter two as one scene, is when he walks into his room and Dobby's on the bed, because this is not expected. You know, I'm thinking out loud now too, like, in theory, you could question, is the announcement that the Masons are coming, Could that be an inciting incident? I mean, maybe, but it's like, do we care? We care more that it's Harry's birthday or that Dobby's on Harry's bed.
Yeah.
Dobby's different because for many reasons, but it brings magic to Harry. Like, this is the magical world coming to his world, and he can't ignore Dobby on his bed, sobbing, making noise, all this stuff. So he can ignore the fact that people forgot his birthday. He can't ignore Dobby.
Mm-hmm. And this is where I'm probably just going to jump in here and tell you that I've already been convinced that we're going this direction, but I still think that it's worth analyzing both of them because it's good to see where we can spin before we start making decisions. Right. And it's also important to reemphasize that, again, there's subjectivity to analyzing stories. So
yeah,
more focus on the Socratic learning methods. So the way that I see something might be different than the way you see something, but it's about analyzing in a way that we can make an argument that there is change in advancement and plot and development of character.
Yes. And for the record, the way that Abigail has this currently broken out is I agree with the analysis she's done. So it's not that it's irrelevant or that we don't want to look at it this way, because like we said, it's a beat and it's causing movement. So we're going to walk through, you'll see what I mean in a second.
Yeah.
But let's say you were to come up in, maybe you're creating a writing group and you're doing these first chapters mm-hmm. because you like stories as much as we do. If everyone comes to the table with a different analysis, it doesn't mean anybody's wrong. We're all going to learn from discussing this and it's going to help us make our own story stronger. So
that's right.
Like to point that out.
Yep. Absolutely. Always, always, always. Because I do think that people then try to make it perfect. It's like, there is no perfection to it. So then the turning point. Now, when I look at scenes, I view the turning point partnered with the crisis decision as the most important thing that happens in a scene. They have to work together. A turning point forces a character into a crisis decision, and a character who acts on a crisis decision therefore acts. And that's what is
that's agency.
And it develops the character, right? So like when I say what makes the scene quote unquote work, I'm looking for is the plot advancing? Is the character being developed? Like, is there a purpose and intention to the events that are happening? And they're not just random, it's purposeful in how we're moving towards that value shift. The turning point for this beat/possible scene, I say is active. And I said it's when Dudley taunts Harry, saying that he has no friends. And the reason why I argue that is because with the exception of this moment, Harry doesn't need to act on anything. He can sidestep things and there aren't consequences. And that's the big thing. A crisis decision comes with consequences, regardless of if you do something or not. And there aren't consequences to Harry not doing anything and anything else in the scene, even including the eyes in the hedge. And that is something that I like to point out because to me, that's the most interesting thing that happens in the chapter.
Yeah.
Because I know it's Harry Potter. I know something big is coming with magic. So I'm actually more interested with that detail. But what this does with Dudley kind of seeking Harry out to bully him forces Harry into a crisis decision of the sense of, and I guess I'll just kind of pair them right now.
Yeah, go ahead.
A crisis decision is either a best bad choice or an irreconcilable goods decision. Best bad choice being both options are going to lead to a consequence, but which is the better? What can the character choose to best get out of this? Reconcilable goods being the inverse of that, in the sense that it's going to maybe benefit the main character making the decision, but it's going to probably, you know, impact a third party or another person in a different way.
Right.
So this is a best bad choice for me because the idea of Harry is forced into this crisis decision of, do I stand up against Dudley or not? And why there are consequences to that is because if Harry doesn't stand up for himself, he continues to allow Dudley to assert power over him. If he does stand up to him, he's out of eyesight of Petunia and Vernon. So there is a chance that maybe he could get away with this. If he does stand up to him, there are consequences of Petunia or Vernon finding out. Dudley is also like a crybaby, so it's likely they'll find out. And he's going to be punished for that. And punishment is harsh in the Dursley house. He ends up with bars on his window.
And no food.
And so Harry, in his kind of like middle grade poke and have fun type of way, is then going to, and I guess I'm speeding through this.
That's okay.
I feel like turning point, crisis, and climax all go together. So I'm just doing it around. Goes into the climax, and the climax is just the character actually acting on the crisis decision. So they're very tightly bound together.
sometimes there's a mini gap with that. We'll talk about that in a second. But most of the time, it's pretty immediate after this decision is not necessarily written word for word on the page, but it's understood that the character is going through this. And Harry does decide to stand up for himself. He pretends to perform magic. He's not actually going to perform magic. Of course, Dudley's going to freak out. And that leads to the resolution. The resolution is everything that happens after the climax. So essentially, it shows us where the character stands mentally and externally based on them making that decision. I had Dudley freaks out. Aunt Petunia punishes Harry with extra chores and a sad dinner, then banishes him to the bedroom. Uncle Vernon warns Harry of the consequences if he makes noise. And then the eyes that he saw in the hedge reappear at the end. And that's the end of the chapter. So now that we see that laid out, we can now tackle option number two, one scene, two chapters.
Yes. And so again, what Abigail just broke down, that totally works as a beat, or whether you call it a scene, whatever you want to say, there's structure, there's change. We get to see Harry's character expressed on the page. There's agency, there's a decision, all the stuff we need. So the way that I was seeing this spread across the two chapters, we said the inciting incident is Dobby appears on Harry's bed and he's kind of a little bit loud, even though he's about to get louder. This tweaks Harry's goal a little bit to stay out of Vernon's way, because now he has something else to worry about. Now it's not just keeping himself and Hedwig quiet. It's keeping himself, Hedwig, and this noisy house elf quiet. So I saw the turning point as when Dobby brings up that there's dangerous things about to happen at Hogwarts and he needs Harry to promise not to return. And specifically, because there's a couple little blips of this happening, specifically when he's got the cake in the air and he's like threatening Harry, if you don't promise me you're not going back, I'm going to like throw this cake on Vernon's guests. At that point, Harry can either stay true to himself and his wishes of returning to Hogwarts and not promise Dobby and risk upsetting Vernon, or he can promise Dobby that he won't go back to Hogwarts and kind of turn his back on everything he wants and stay off Vernon's radar. So to me, I'm like, that's the crisis decision. It relates to the global story because Dobby's telling him, if you go back to Hogwarts, there's danger. So the climax is that Harry refuses to promise. He can't do it because he wants to go back to Hogwarts. And again, this shows what Harry values. He values his friendship. He values his magical education. He wants to go where he belongs. So the resolution that I had was Dobby drops the cake on Mrs. Mason's head and Harry gets into big trouble. He did not accomplish his scene goal, which is to stay out of Vernon's way. And the visit went terrible. So like, not only did he not accomplish it, now he's in big trouble. Mm-hmm. So that's how I saw the scene over the course of the two chapters, which means if this is the way we want to analyze it, it's a super long scene.
Yep.
And maybe we're okay with that because of all the setup we needed to do. And she did it, like we said earlier, in an interesting way. So it's not just like in book one, here's what you missed.
Right.
It's told through narrative. So we're a little more accepting of it.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to let you know why I am siding with Savannah after this discussion, because I think that one thing you have to think about is going back to that goal and that originally established in the beginning, which is staying out of Vernon's way.
Right.
Basically, don't
poke the bear.
Right. Yeah. Don't poke that rhinoceros.
Yeah, the angry rhinoceros.
That angry rhinoceros. So this means that we then, because we're thinking that's the one and the five commandments are going to unravel whether or not we change, the value shifts, like Savannah just mentioned, speaks more to the action story, speaks more to the global plot. And in the beginning of a story, it's important that we are understanding, why is this relevant? How will this connect? And that then makes me curious, because I think that the five commandments in that way works better. It also ties in the inciting incident of the entire story, which interestingly is like a call to adventure in reverse, because basically It's going to hint at what the big thing is going to be. Does Harry essentially fight the basilisk or not? Does he face the heir of Slytherin or not? But it's in reverse because Dobby says, don't take on this adventure versus
don't accept.
So yeah. I think it's an innovative way of planting a call to adventure in the story. We then have to turn our attention to
if that works, this is the way we're analyzing scenes. So it's not the traditional sense of scenes. One definition of scenes you might have seen is that when setting changes, that a scene changes. And there obviously is a setting change from the garden, kitchen to the bedroom. Right. So just kind of as a sense there, we're looking at scenes in this way of outlining it in the Five Commandments, just to kind of clarify any confusion there. I think the other thing that we have to ask ourselves, because this is an episode on first chapters, why does the first chapter, if it is a beat, still engage the readers? And when you said, you kind of said it there in a second, Savannah, it's exposition, but it's done in an interesting way. So what do you think is so interesting about the first chapter that would engage the readers and get them to read up forward?
Yeah. Well, and one of the things is what we just called out, that there is a beat within that first chapter. So it's not just a bunch of stuff. There's movement through that beat, through this interaction with Dudley. Part of it is that we're also in love with Harry Potter, that we're like, oh my gosh, give me the exposition. I don't even care, right? Which is something that not all of us are ever going to probably get to do with our own books. So
well, maybe, okay,
right? maybe. But like realistically, we have to look under the surface of like, okay, well, we could get lucky and have that experience, sure. But A, there's something like that we care about. Even though we don't like Vernon, we don't want Harry to get in trouble. So we care that he doesn't upset Vernon, that the Mason's visit goes well, that, you know, he stands up to Dudley, all these different things. There, like Abigail said, there are eyes in the bush. We know that's going to mean something. We're also curious and wondering, like, why aren't Ron and Hermione communicating with Harry?
Yes.
That's a big question mark.
Yes. And I think you've hit the nail on the wall there with the sense of there is suspense and mystery woven into this immediately. And because we care about Harry, and I do think that this first chapter really grounds us into caring about character more than anything else, we want to figure out why the events of his life are making it more miserable than an already miserable life needs to be. So
yeah,
I think that that is really great and it's going to push you forward. Just to kind of reemphasize too, the exposition that we're mainly talking about is the recap of Hogwarts, mentioning some big characters like Snape's mentioned, Dumbledore's mentioned. Big characters are named in the exposition, laying out what happened in the events in the previous book. It probably goes over the course of like maybe 2 to 3 pages. So in the grand scheme of the chapter, I think it also returns to, it's not just, let me tell you about Hogwarts. Action does still happen, right? That technically kind of threatens Harry's safety in the sense that he goes from a value shift. If you were to turn back to what is the value shift now in if it was two scenes or one scene, if you look at it as two scenes, I think that you can argue there's a value shift in the beat of something of the sense of ignored to punished, like something like that. Now, one thing that I'd like to address quickly, because we're going to look at it as one scene over two chapters, is that the difference between a beat versus a scene. Maybe in a scene, there's a value shift, but in a beat, there's a change in tactic. That is when we start to kind of look at this. Can we argue that maybe it's not a value shift in the first chapter? It's actually a change in tactic. And there's actually a value shift only in the change of one scene, two chapters. So, go ahead.
So pausing there on the change in tactic. So she's referring to if his goal is to stay off Vernon's radar and to not get in trouble. It's like now that Dudley's out here with me and bullying me, how am I going to get around this to still accomplish my goal? So his tactic changes, but nothing big picture necessarily is changing.
Yes. And this is why I think I'm really going to side with one scene, two chapters, because although there is change in the scene, it's not significant enough to be a value change. It's kind of like negative to double negative, but did something really change? Not as significantly as going from I'm having a terrible birthday to I'm maybe never going back to Hogwarts at all.
Right.
Like that's much bigger in your face, negative to double negative. If you step back and you don't try to force it into two scenes, two chapters, you allow room for the events to breathe in a way that creates a more significant change that speaks the big picture story. And going back to the seven questions, like that's the big thing. What is the big picture story and how is that moving forward?
So that's really interesting. The beat thing is not something to worry about on a first draft, probably, just because I know some of us can get a little analytical. The other thing I wanted to say, back to what you mentioned about the exposition, is that what I noticed is it's delivered in a way that's like, the thing I miss most is visiting Hagrid's hut and playing Quidditch. Mm-hmm. So it's filtered through how Harry's feeling in that moment.
Yeah.
It's not like Harry went to school last year at Hogwarts and he played Quidditch where Hogwarts won the school cup and blah, blah, blah. It's like, this is literally what he's thinking about.
Exactly.
Yes. It's organically put in the scene, which is how we want to deliver the exposition. So just something to think about, because otherwise it gets to be a lot.
It's something that it's almost because it's a sequel, I think that there's this rare exception to having more room to do that than if it were the first in a series or first book in general.
One thing too, I noticed towards the end of, I think it's either in the middle of the second chapter or whatever, but one of the things that also helped me decide or come to the table with, like, I think it's one big scene, is that Harry says something like, Uncle Vernon might have been able to make this deal if not for the owl. So the owl comes
after
he's done the magic, right? Yep, and after Dobby's the dropped there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So,
which is different than the movie. So pay attention to the book.
That's why I was like, confused.
There is no owl in the really. Yeah. Well, I guess there is. It delivers a letter, but yeah.
Yeah. And so the fact that he's kind of telling us I'm concerned Uncle Vernon could have made this deal if not for the owl.
Yeah.
So he's still in that goals mindset that he was in the very beginning.
That's a super specific and amazing point that you just made.
It's funny because, like, part of me comes to this and I don't want to disagree with Abigail, because I'm like, I know you've already turned in this draft and you've worked so hard on it. But then when we find evidence for stuff like this in a text, both of our like nerd alerts go off and we're like, okay, we can feel really good about this now because there's evidence.
Yeah. And I just want to say, I love that you challenged it, because that helps me understand something. Sometimes when you spend so much time with something, it makes it easier for you to miss details like that. That's where an editor can be really interesting as they step in, because it's fresh to them.
And I think we mentioned last time, Abigail's been my editor on Sorcerer's Stone. So we are used to having these conversations where it's like, you know, the only reason I'm saying this is because if you are trying to find a writing buddy, find someone who's going to be more on your team than like, let me point out what you're doing wrong.
Yeah.
Because that's not what we're doing. We don't do that to each other. And
no.
It's like the best, most fun relationship and the best way to analyze stories.
Yeah.
So
I get excited when she sees something different than me. Yeah. It's like, I'm like, oh, this podcast episode is going to be even better than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
So I think that it's like, it's one of those things that when you get feedback in any way, you should have that trust and support of one another in a way that it's not about power here. It's about helping each other just become better at stories through study.
Yeah. And it's funny because even yesterday when I was like, oh, I don't know if you're going to be happy with what I'm saying. And then neither of us are like, let's push pause. Let's wait until we agree. And like, here's how we work through it.
Right.
Just because we know everyone else is probably doing this in a vacuum. So anyway, the one last thing I had on my notes was, I thought it was so cool that Dobby mentions how a house elf can be set free in this opening.
Yes, 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 yes. So
it's
important.
Such a throwaway detail, but it becomes that nice mirror image to the very end when Harry does give him a sock.
Mm-hmm.
And I just gave myself goosebumps because I love that part in the story. It's set up in just this little throwaway detail. And a lot of times I work with sci-fi fantasy writers and they're like, I don't know how to set up these things. And I'm like, get through like five drafts and then come back to your first chapter and plant the things you need. It's never going to be something you think about when you're sitting out to write that first scene.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ever.
I love that you're saying that. House elves in general, and this is the first introduction to house elves. And I think that house elves in particular are one of the coolest things, how they are implemented into the story and how they speak to bigger messages, as well as essential to plot advancement and character development, are one of the greatest examples that you could look at from implementing big ideas and character and plot into this like one element of story, this one character, right? So we know in Chamber of Secrets, because Dobby creates chaos, that anytime Dobby shows up, he's actually one of the main forces of antagonism for Harry Potter in the Chamber of Secrets. He's technically an ally, but he's one of the main forces of antagonism in the story. So it's like good intentions gone wrong.
And pause there, because that's important, because a lot of people, they hear you need more conflict in the scene, or what's the sense of antagonism and they're like, well, I don't want to create a character or like have my character trip over roots or anything. And it's like, they always think it needs to be bad. But what you're saying is Dobby's interest, he has really good intentions. It just misaligns with what Harry wants.
If I can teach anything to anyone in this episode through that, that lens of like, what is important with antagonists, I really like to clarify that antagonist does not equal villain. Okay. There is a villain in the story. In an action story, there will be a villain. There has to be a hero, victim, villain triangle of sorts. That villain is Voldemort, right? In this book, in the series. So technically Tom Riddle, but you know, same thing. Yeah. So I think that going to that idea, antagonist very often actually is a supporting character that is on the team of the main character, because on the scene level, you have to, the whole thing about an antagonist is just that their want is conflicting with the other character's want, or their way of getting a want
right
conflicts with that. Like, look at any traditional story of any sort. Like, a mentor is very often an antagonist for a hero because they're challenging them. And
yeah, they push on that wound. Yeah. And they want the best thing for the character. The most fun example is in a romance where it's like the other lead is the antagonist.
Yep.
And you wouldn't normally think that because it's like, oh, but they're the love interest. Yeah. They push on the wound and help the character grow. And they just, like, the easy example is they might be fighting for the same job. So that puts them against each other, but they're not a villain.
Yep, exactly. Conflict is what makes stories, because conflict is what creates change. So the thing is, all stories need conflict. All scenes need conflict, with the very rare exceptions, maybe like less than 1% scenes that are just exposition. But ultimately, that idea of conflict is going to get the character to change, because until we have conflict, we don't have a reason to change.
The other thing I just quickly want to point out, that how fun is this if you think about it from Dobby's perspective, because he faces a crisis too, which to me, when I can identify other characters in the background that are making their own decisions, I'm like, this is a good working scene. Yes. Like, Dobby wants one thing. Like you said, he's the antagonist of this scene. Harry wants another thing. When Dobby can't get the promise from Harry, he faces a crisis. Do I leave or do I try to force him to make a decision and say, I promise?
A big thing with that is Dobby worships Harry.
Yeah, the point of tears. And he knows, I mean, there's stakes for Dobby too, which makes it more interesting. He could get in trouble with the Malfoys. He could lose Harry. He could upset Harry. There's a ton of he could be seen by the Muggles. That's cool to think about it from different lenses. I always like to point these things out, because if you get stuck writing a scene, you could switch into the antagonist point of view and say, well, what would they do? What's their motivation? And then maybe that'll help you construct the action on the page, which could then help you create the five commandments and that movement.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a fun one. And I'm interested to see when we do book number three. And maybe someday we'll do a bonus Lockhart episode, because
oh my gosh, every that book chapter. Has...
Yeah. Same with the Diagon Alley chapter in book one. They're really hard. It's like every time he goes to Diagon Alley, and part of it is because there's probably so many beats that you're like, how do we break this up?
Yeah.
So I know all of us ran into that issue in the Diagon Alley chapters in our book.
Oh my gosh. So hard. Really tough to analyze.
Someday we'll come back and do one of those episodes.
Yeah, but. Sounds good. Well, Savannah, it's so wonderful to have you. I know it was longer for everyone out there, but I hope that you have tons of great things to take away and that time was of good use to you.
So that's it for today's show. As always, I want to thank you so much for tuning in and showing your support. If you want to check out any of the links I mentioned in this episode, you can find them over at savannahgilbo.com/podcast. And if you haven't done so already, make sure you subscribe to the show, because there's going to be another brand new episode coming out next week. If you're an Apple user, I'd really appreciate it if you took a few seconds to leave a quick rating and review. Your ratings and reviews tell iTunes that this is a podcast that's worth listening to. And in turn, that helps this show get in front of more fiction writers just like you. So that's it for today's show. I'll be back next week with a brand new episode. Until then, happy writing.